This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Our second reader will be Mr. Jonathan L. Howard.
Cowboy Kim. The gun spins, and it spins, and it spins. It spins on the cowboy's finger, his hand mechanically flicking in an eccentric circle to make the gun spin, and spin, and spin. The cowboy's eyes are dead. His mind is dormant, but the autonomic processes and conditioned reflexes are still in place, and so his lungs fill in exhaust, his heart beats, and the gun spins. The gun is large and heavy, a Remington 44 1858 New Army pattern. It has six chambers in its cylinder, and the cylinder can be removed and replaced with a preloaded one for when six large caliber rounds aren't enough. It is a fierce gun. Clint Eastwood carried a Remington 44 in Pale Rider. But it's no museum piece. It was built less than 5 years ago by a Swiss gunsmith who specializes in period facsimiles. This Remington is made from modern alloys and is nitro-tested to Magnum standards, allowing it to fire 44 Magnum rounds like a modern Smith & Wesson. Clint Eastwood carried a Magnum 44 in Dirty Harry. It is a very fierce gun. It is loaded with blanks. They make a noise and flash. It is a fierce gun loaded with blank rounds. It is a tiger with its teeth drawn. The warm-up comedian is just finishing his set. He ignores the first cue from the floor manager to wind up, but the second follows 4 seconds later, along with a silently mouthed direction to fuck off. The comedian's smile never falters. He says something unrehearsed and unfunny. Then he says, "It's the Cowboy Kim Show," and walks off set. His fixed smile becomes loose and falls from his face. The comedian knows that he is unnecessary. Quarter an hour earlier, the audience were given free water and fruit juice. Both are loaded with tailored amphetamines. Already they are taking effect. Two paramedic crews are on standby. In the 5 hours that the show will run, there will be, on average, two medical emergencies. Not that the people at home will ever know that. The gallery is adept at never showing an audience member in convulsions. The comedian knows that his main role is distracting the audience from the chemical taste of their free drinks. The clock ticks down. The regents hand over to the studio. It's showtime. The band strikes up. Once upon a time, they'd warned people that this was the future they were sleepwalking into, but nobody listened. So here they are. Even Cassandra has to eat. One plays drums, three play keyboards, and one plays a Mike Bloomfield Les Paul guitar against a click track of synthesized hoofbeats. Also in the backing track are binaural waves intended to stimulate alpha and theta responses in the brains of the audience, both in the studio and at home. Even if they don't like the show, they will think they do. The binaurals are buried within the sound of a Jew's harp. It's okay to call it a Jew's harp. The dancers are streamed out, four of them dressed as cowgirls and four of them as squaws. It's okay to call them squaws. It's okay to call them Red Indians. It's okay to call them Injuns. All of the dancers are British. None of them has even a drop of North American blood in their veins. Two of the squaws are Caucasian. They take monthly supplements to boost their melanin. Their costumes combine elements from three different Native American nations, none of whom may seek legal redress. It's okay to have squaws in the show. The North American nations were bought off. It's okay to pull the edges of your eyes down and speak chinky-chonky. It's okay to wear blackface, redface, yellowface, paleface, any face you want, as long as you have the correct licensing agreement. It was a great, great day. They commoditize dignity. None of them know anything about how the Sioux or the Comanche or the Lakota dance. These dancers are all pole dancers who won a reality show. They have fierce smiles and strip club moves. They are bumping and grinding for a family audience. Something for everybody. In the gallery, the key is pressed, and behind the scenes, the cowboy comes to life. The stimulus strikes him and his mind becomes receptive. recognising the intro to the show's theme, triggering another conditioned reflex. The gun stops spinning, and he grips the butt firmly as he steps forward, ignoring the floor assistants around him, and stepping upon a waiting skateboard. He drives the transparent skateboard forward fiercely, with a couple of energetic pushes, before placing both booted feet upon the deck. On the set, he appears high, at the top of a ramp leading down around the frontage of a saloon. The studio audience meets him with rapturous applause and cheering, made hysterical by the addition of their covert drugging. He glides down, his balance perfect. He fires the pistol twice up at the lighting rigs. At the bottom of the ramp, he throws himself forwards, hits a concealed mat with his shoulder, rolls and comes up onto his feet, snatching the waiting microphone from the hand of one of the cowgirls. He always uses a handheld microphone. It's part of his brand. He starts to sing. I am Cowboy Kim. Cowboy Kim I am. I am a lucky cowboy. Now let me tell you why. The song is based on a series of anonymous notes an agency handling fan mail for game show hosts received in the 1970s. They were random and repetitive, written in a childish hand. The Cowboy Kim Show is great, said one note. The Cowboy Kim Show is super. A good cowboy I am. Somebody wrote a song inspired by the notes, and then the company bought the rights to that song and secured all copyrights to the name and concepts contained therein. If the original writer of the notes ever wrote another one, he'd be sued into oblivion. I'm a man with a mission, a boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. Cowboy Kim's hat is a Stetson, an off-white Stetson, to hint that there's some ante to his hero. The hat band is a length of rainbow ribbon cable, the ends disappearing into a small box mounted on the left side of the crown. Cowboy Kim is a modern cowboy, an ultra-modern cowboy, a cowboy of the future, and this is represented by rainbow ribbon cable. The Whippersnapper's Guide to Cowboy Kim says the box allows him to interface directly with PrairieNet, the Wild West's communication network by which he combats his enemies in the syndicated cartoon, Colby, Pierce, Miller, and the dreaded Johnny Quaid. The box is white, 8 centimetres by 5 centimetres by 2. The outer side shows a Cowboy Kim logo, a black silhouette of Kim with his gun hand outstretched and the Remington pointing to the right, his offhand up and behind him, counterbalancing like a fencer. It is a very popular logo. You can see it on t-shirts, tattoos, on the concrete walls everywhere. A lot of focus groups made a lot of stupid comments about a lot of logos before the company settled on that one. Apart from kids who believe in the prairie net, everyone knows that the box is really empty. The box is not really empty. The hat band acts as an aerial. The hat conceals contacts for subcranial implants. The box contains bespoke electronic components. The military cannot afford the development of a device like the box, but TV can. The gallery is arranged with a row of seats in front of the monitor bank and a soundproof glass window looking down upon the studio. The director sits flanked by the production assistant and the technical director at the vision and audio mix controls, the still store and all. Unusually for a production control room, there is a raised area behind them, upon which there is a very comfortable chair in which the station owner sits, the king upon his throne. He says little, but his displeasure is obvious when manifest. Against the right-hand wall is another unusual station that barely has a view of the studio floor at all. Just a group of monitors showing the feed from all four cameras and the telemetry relayed from Cowboy Kim's hat. The man at this station is called Dr. Ost. Now, Dr. Ost's a clever man. Dr. Ost's never forgotten anything he's ever learned, with the sole exception of the Hippocratic Oath, upon which he is now very vague. Dr. Ost is a valuable man to the station. Dr. Ost makes people mad for entertainment purposes. Cowboy Kim is the second person he has made mad. The first person Dr. Ost made mad for entertainment purposes was called Crazy Ivan. He was controlled by precisely measured quantities of psychotomimetic drugs. One evening, they weren't so precisely measured, and Crazy Ivan went crazy. While Ivan was attacking the audience, the studio put up a picture of a young girl playing noughts and crosses with a soft toy for an opponent. While the armed response team was entering the studio, the gallery put up a caption saying, "We are sorry, we are experiencing technical problems. Normal service will be resumed as soon as possible," in a cartoon drawing of a sad face. While the armed response team was shooting Ivan with their submachine guns, we should be precise, they were Heckler & Koch MP5s, product placement is so important, the home audience was watching a film of kittens playing with balls of yarn. Dr. Oster's learned from such mistakes. He would never use such techniques to drive a person mad in such a way that they get excellent viewing figures ever again. Now he uses microelectronics and brain surgery. He has flooded Cowboy Kim's brain with information that makes him believe that he truly is a cowboy. The unknown hinterlands of the brain with no obvious function, he has filled them by uploading thousands of hours of Western movies, hundreds of thousands of words of Western novels. He has pumped Cowboy Kim so full of the mythical Old West, there was no room for insanity. Now Zane Grey and Audie Murphy haunt the synapses of Cowboy Kim, and Cowboy Kim no longer has the faintest idea that he was ever somebody else before he was Cowboy Kim. That's what Dr. Ost thinks, anyway. But he's not quite correct. Some days, Kim has a faint inkling that his life is not his own. Some days, Kim thinks that there's something wrong about being left in a room wearing nappies while he watches a loop of Gunsmoke, Bonanza, The High Chaparral, and every Western that John Wayne, Gary Cooper, Jimmy Stewart, and Clint Eastwood ever made. Some days, Kim gets bored of laboriously eating spoonfuls of pureed beef protein. Most days, he spends in a catatonic state. He dreams of being somebody who isn't Cowboy Kim. He can't recall much about this person that is him, but isn't Cowboy Kim. He thinks he worked at a TV station, whatever one of those is. He thinks maybe he was important. He dreams he had an old Mickey Mouse phone, a collector's piece, that he broke the ears off just to show that he didn't care, and anyway he was rich enough to get another. He's not 100% sure, but he suspects that when he wasn't Cowboy Kim, he was a bit of an arsehole. I'm a man with a mission, a boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. Who doesn't know? I'm a big mess, I mean a really big mess. The band backs him with a big, big mess, and he was all mixed up in a big mess. Big mess. He was really mixed up. One repetition, and then into the instrumental break, Kim spins across the set like a dervish. His balance is perfect, because his reactions have been artificially accelerated for the duration of the song. He also dances well. He was taught to do the spin in one afternoon. The choreographer was nonplussed by him being in full cowboy regalia, long coat, boots and Stetson, and by the presence of Dr. Ost with a mobile control station, but he asked no questions because that's not wise where television is concerned. They have armed security. Cowboy Kim learned the spin quickly, and the choreographer was impressed. "He is very motivated," said Dr. Ost. He did not tell the choreographer that the motivation consisted of the character stimulation to the pleasure centres of the cowboy's brain when he got it right, and the stick of stimulation to the pain centres of the cowboy's brain when he got it wrong. Now Cowboy Kim spins across the floor to a background of sweating women with fierce smiles. In the gallery, Dr. Ost watches Kim on four monitors. He casually slides one control down towards zero. Out on the studio floor, Kim's sense of balance starts to fail. The lights and faces flash past him in an incoherent, eccentric orbit of too much. He staggers, starts to topple. The audience gasps. In the gallery, the studio head coughs. Dr. Ost looks over to see the studio head looking significantly at him. Dr. Ost smiles slightly and shrugs, even as he is pushing the control back upwards. In the studio, Kim's reflexes become inhumanly acute. He easily recovers from the spinning fall to cheers and whoops from the audience, now almost frothing with uncontainable excitement. The camera, getting reaction shots of the audience, is at pains not to show the medical team currently defibrillating a man in one of the aisles. They work quietly, using hand signals. Charging, clear, and shock. Cowboy Kim I am, Mr. Reality, the most important thing now. I put away my toys. Colby, Pierce, Miller and Quaid only exist as cartoons. They appear in the windows of the saloon backdrop, wearing black hats, of course. Cowboy Kim turns and fires as they appear. Pierce and Miller share a window, so only one shot is required to make them duck back behind cover. This is as important as it leaves Kim with one blank in his six-shooter. There were management meetings to decide this. The song is entering its last phase. Who doesn't know? I'm a big mess. I mean, a really big mess. A big, big mess, and he was all mixed up in our two synthesizer notes. And he fires his final round on the last, gun raised to bear on the studio ceiling. There's a beat of silence, and then the audience thunders with mad approval. The dancers stream past Cowboy Kim as they walk off set in two streams, as choreographed as everything else, smiling at him as they go by. Close up, they can see that his eyes are dead. It makes it hard for them to smile, even with all their practice. He smiles back, for he's a star and a charismatic cowboy to boot. In the gallery, the director chooses a shot that best shows a gleam of sweat on eight cleavages as they go by. Cowboy Kim does a super show. He spins the Remington 44 one last time before slamming it home to its holster. He smiles at the audience, an open, honest smile. It has to be honest. He has long since lost sufficient brain function to permit lying. He smiles for the long seconds that the audience continue to applaud, not least because they're having trouble remembering how to stop. Finally, the sweet moment arrives. The director cues Dr. Ost with a hand signal, and Dr. Ost cues Cowboy Kim with a coded trigger delivered to the prefrontal cortex. Cowboy Kim opens his mouth, and he speaks. Thank you. I should add, the song in that is Big Mess, and it's not mine. It's by Devo. And so I thought there might be copyright considerations. So I got in touch with Jerry Casale of Devo, and he said, do it, just be sure to give them a credit at some point. So, Devo, 1982 to 2013. Thank you, Jerry. Right, I've got time for another little bit, yes? Okay, well, I shall be swift. I suppose I'm reasonably well known for the Johannes Cabal books. There's a new one coming out next year, and so far the title is undecided. That's been the company line. Actually, the title was decided when I started writing it. This is the first time the title is going to be publicly announced. The prologue from the fourth Johannes Cabal novel, The Brothers Cabal. Prologue, in which we are reintroduced to a pair of individuals with unconventional interpretations of the term dead. Now, let us consider the life of Johannes Cabal, if briefly. He is closing on his 30th year and he's aging better than most. Although this is a product of a lifestyle where sunlight is shunned rather than the assiduous use of moisturizer. He stands a little over 6 feet tall. He is blonde, blue-eyed and perforce pale. These are not unusual characteristics. Those are coming. He has killed himself twice. Been resurrected once, the second death was a practical joke of sorts, visited hell twice, penetrated the wall of sleep into the dreamlands in corporeal form once, went as a human, came back as a monster. But the monstrousness has now left him, albeit terribly ill. He has time-travelled in a rambling and undisciplined fashion, but he was a monster at the time, and travelling time was of little import to him, except as a means to an end, and as a way to upset the Vatican, which was a perk. Ill unto death, he returned to his strange little isolated house to recuperate, yet could not enter, since his front garden was conspiring to kill and eat him. He saw then that this was to be an ignominious death, to slowly shuffle off the mortal coil while propped against the gatepost of his home, mere yards from salvation. It did not surprise him. It is a lot of a necromancer, too, in all likelihood, die an ignominious death, and he could only sigh a small sigh of relief that it didn't involve zombies, because that would have been tiresome. So necromancer that he was, one of some little infamy yet, he settled down to rattle out his last breath in as much comfort as he could. And there he might have expired, and his bones lay to the inexpressible frustration of the criminally insane and eternally hungry fairies that were contained within his dangerous garden. Yet salvation came, and it came in the form of a taciturn figure who effortlessly picked Cabal up and walked up the garden path with the comatose necromancer carelessly slung over one shoulder. At this new presence, the starving unseelie of the garden scattered in fear, because that which is a supernatural and nasty knows supernatural and nastier when it sees it. The figure opened the front door, a hefty artifact of English oak and triple locked with a London bar device to resist kicking, and kicked it clean out of its frame, and carried Cabal within. The synthesis of an antidote for Cabal's overly energetic rehumanization, slowing it to a rate his constitution could withstand, was managed within an hour or so, and he was saved. The recovery of his health, however, was not so swift. For a week, he wavered in and out of consciousness, rarely awake but for brief periods in the day during which he saw no one else. He was tended to as he slept during the hours of darkness, for his benefactor would not countenance the sun. And again, this was for reasons that had nothing to do with making savings in moisturizers. Cabal was fed and cleaned, and he was barely aware of it. And the memory left him quickly, with a glance into deep, inhuman eyes, and a whisper, "Not yet, Johannes, when you are stronger." As Cabal's strength returned, he grew closer to the waking world. At some deep level, he was glad of that, for the dust of the dreamlands was still on his feet, and there were things he was happy to leave there. On the other hand, his awareness of his surroundings was increasing, and while his perception that he was back in his own home and not, say, swinging from a gibbet was soothing, the nagging gap in his memory between dying by the gatepost and comfy under an eiderdown was beginning to trouble him. Finally, the evening came when he fought his eyes open and looked upon the man who had saved his life, and the man judged he would not take away the memory and let Johannes Cabal sleep again, for time was passing, and it might be that another evening's sleep would lead to the death of the world. The man was not keen for that to happen. Cabal looked at the man, and he was astonished, and yet so profoundly relieved that when he spoke, the first word was almost a sob. "You," he said, his voice thin and weak from illness and disuse. "It's you. But you're dead." His brother, Horst Cabal, sat upon the edge of the bed and looked at him. He was a man who had lived, died briefly, become undead, become very dead indeed, and yet now seemed to be undead again. "Yeah," he agreed a mite awkwardly, as if being found alive of sorts, when he was supposed to be profoundly dead, was morally equivalent to using the wrong spoon at dinner. The awkwardness extended into an awkward pause. "Would you..." Horst looked off for a moment, finding something fascinating about the picture rail. He looked back at Cabal. "We'd like some soup, Johannes." The soup, it was chicken, was good. Though that was not the unusual thing about it. That it'd been prepared by a man who was dead twice over was more notable. Johannes Cabal, an invalid of some little infamy, sat upright in his bed and slowly sipped the soup. He considered that life was an unpredictable sort of thing. If past events had been different by one single factor, he would probably be a solicitor by this time. He would likely be married, his father would still be alive, his mother would not have disowned him, and his brother would not have died twice and now be making him soup. It was hard to characterise his feelings as to how such things could come to pass. He had to make do with, "It's a funny old world." The wind moaned around the eaves of Cabal's house, a nondescript three-story structure common in the cantons of the petty bourgeois found in most English towns, rendered descript by standing in the splendid isolation of a remote hillside. It had clearly not been built there, but the mechanism by which it had somehow been transplanted complete and without damage remained a mystery to man and civic planner alike. Behind it sat a small back garden with a herbaceous border that needed attention, and a woodshed from which very occasionally movement could be heard. Before it was a small tangled rose garden within which small creatures of fey descent, malign intent, and ill manners hid and watched. The garden and the path that led from one of those waist-high gates in terms of the mark of a property line, rather than represent any serious barrier to the front door of the house, was bordered by a low stone wall that was no more of an impedance than the gate. In truth, there was more to the apparently inconsequential wall and gate than met the eye, a state of affairs that extended to much of the house and its contents. Cabal regarded the black panes of the window, beyond which the small valley his house overlooked lay in darkness, and he listened to the wind blow. When he felt a light breeze disturb the hairs on his arm, however, he knew it had nothing to do with the weather. "I am not easily astonished, Horst," he said, continuing to look at the dark glass. "But in this, you have succeeded." He turned his head to regard his brother. He was standing by the door in his shirt sleeves, looking very much at home. Then again, this had once been his home. Cabal noted that the door was closed. "I didn't even hear the door open and shut. Your abilities have progressed since last we met." "Perhaps I didn't open the door, Johannes," said his brother. Horst still looked like a man in his early 20s, even though he was older than Cabal, at least according to the calendar. Being dead suited him very well. He was still abominably virile and thoughtlessly handsome in the same way that had always made Cabal hate the sight of him. Like brown hair, only a few shades away from blonde and blue-eyed, he would look good in a sack. Still, sibling rivalry was a thing for one's youth and should be put away when one is a serious profession, such as necromancy, and one's brother is one of the blood-drinking undead. "Perhaps I turned into a cloud of vapour and came through the keyhole. And perhaps you transformed yourself into a flood of eyewash and burbled beneath it. Don't patronise me. I have some knowledge of your kind." Once Horst might have risen to a comment like, "your kind." Now, however, he sat on the side of Cabal's bed and murmured, "The time has come," the walrus said. Cabal regarded his soup. It was a phrase from their childhood. Whenever things got out of hand and the air needed clearing, it would be presaged by that little bit of carol. "True enough. There's a great deal to be said. I doubt shoes and ships and sealing wax will be the half of it." He took the tray from his lap and was just manoeuvring awkwardly to put it on the bedside cabinet when Horst appeared in front of him. There was no intermediate walking around the bed. He simply appeared with no more fuss than another of those light breezes to mark the transition. He took the tray and walked in a more conventional manner to the sideboard. "Would you be so kind as to slam that down with enough vigour to make a sharp sound?" called Cabal after him. "I was intending to do it myself to indicate my state of mind before you turned all Florence Nightingale." Horst paused, then put the tray down sharply enough to make the spoon dance in the bowl. "Thank you," said Cabal. "Now, how the hell is it that you're not dead? Properly dead? I saw you die, and you were little more than smoke and ashes by the time the sun had finished with you. Believe you me, I know dead, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone quite so thoroughly dead as you." His voice had risen, as a little colour his recuperation had brought him had drained from his face. "It's lovely to see you again, too, Johannes." Horst walked round the bed to return to his sitting place. "I can tell you're delighted." "I shall doubtless be delighted at some near future date. For the moment, however, I am consumed with the desire to know how it is that my brother, who was dead and then undead and then dead again, now manages to once again be merely undead." Horst shrugged. "Perhaps it's a cyclic thing." It was calculated to irritate, calculated with the finesse that only brothers can attain, and it succeeded like pepper under an eyelid. "If I had my strength," began Cabal, but Horst interrupted him with, "Even if you did, I could still pick you up with one hand and put you back to bed." He waited until Cabal's wrath succeeded to an aggrieved fuming before saying, "It's a long story, and it will take one night to tell. Then I will sleep, and if you have any sense, you will sleep too." Even Cabal's short temper was a poor match for his curiosity. "What do you mean?" The curiosity deepened into suspicion. "Why exactly are you here, Horst?" For once, Horst seemed awkward and unsure how to proceed. Finally, a forced smile appeared on his face. He slapped his knees and stood to look around the room. "It's funny being back in the old house again. After all this time, there's still a gap in the terrace to this day, you know. I'm not sure anyone feels confident enough to build there again, in case whatever they build vanishes too. It took a while to find you. Some detective work. I had to ask around. I've heard some interesting things about you, Johannes, but that all took time." The smile flickered out. "There's not much time left." You need me for something, that much is evident. It cannot be something minor, as imagine there are devils in the pit you'd rather deal with than come running to me. Well, hardly running. Why me? As extraordinary as I am, it is a big world and there must be alternatives. If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have died once, never mind twice. You wouldn't have been reborn once, never mind... I must admit, the second resurrection confuses me. For what it's worth, I don't hold you responsible for the second time. You're not supposed to come back even once, as a general principle. Well, nobody was more surprised than I, said Horse. At least nobody was until your very gratifying reaction when you finally recovered consciousness. I was not! Cabal fought back and subsided. Actually, yes, I was. There's no other way of characterizing it. I was surprised. Very surprised. You were gobsmacked. Banjaxed. And any number of similar terms that you obviously don't know. Horst lied dry, laughed dryly. As for why you, well, because I know you and you're good at what you do. You're assuming a lot. Well, you'll help. Want to help once you understand the circumstances of my return and what followed it. Besides, as I say, I heard things about you when I was looking for this place. Horst closed his eyes for a moment, steeling himself. And the second time I died, I gave up, Johannes. I'd had enough of you. Enough of everything, really. I belonged dead. You all set to become a bigger monster than I could stand to see. Perhaps, he sighed, not looking at Cabal, perhaps I was a coward. I just couldn't bear to watch. Still, even as dark a cloud as the Ministerium has a silver lining. He raised a finger to hush Cabal. You'll hear all about that presently. The important thing is that they undid my mistake. Your mistake? I should have waited. I should have watched. You've done good, Johannes. As a side effect, I know, but there's something in you that wasn't there before. I can only guess that it is your soul. There was a silence, marked only by the heavy ticking of the old grandfather clock in the hall below. Then Johannes Cabal said, I see. May I vomit now? Be my guest. No, really, I think I drank my soup too quickly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Alrighty, everybody. We seem to all have our drinks replenished and whatever, so let's do a quick little Q&A with our two lovely readers from this evening. We'll start with Ian. It seems to me that story came right out of the little research meeting that we had here about BristolCon, where Eugene Byrne gave us all this magnificent background information. I was wondering what attracted you about those particular aspects of Bristol that you chose to use.
Some of it was already familiar, so William Freescreen, I knew quite a lot about already, because I'm very interested in film and interested in cricket, so the W.G. Grace stuff I knew already. One of the things which I did use was, Eugene mentioned, actually I think it wasn't that evening, I think it was when Talkie did a BristolCon a couple of years ago, and he was talking about things about the walkways that through the city and the plan in the 40s and 50s to have this kind of like levelled city. So I sort of took that to an extreme, so you know, the story deliberately, you know, the first scene is right down in the mud, right in the lowest depths you can get to, and then the second scene is literally up in the air to try and sort of, you know, extend that even further, and obviously the class divide is hopefully fairly obvious as well, but and there's various other bits that Eugene mentioned as well, which I did, you know, make use of, shall we say.
I'm particularly happy to have some cricket in it. I hope that Somerset managed to win that game, despite the fact that the good doctor made 100 in it. Now, that story is going to be in airship-shaped and Bristol fashion, which will be out as soon as I can get the final bits of editing done on it. But you do actually have another story in a book which was published in a tearing hurry, which I think our friend Pete Sutton might know a little bit about. You've got a story in The Kraken Rises that we did at the Festival of Literature. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a very silly story, but it's hopefully entertaining. The whole project was a lot of fun to do, and if they do another one next year, I'd recommend people give it a go. The speed thing was definitely an issue, and it's I think most of the people who probably wrote stories for that would have liked to have had a little bit more time to kind of polish them, but the whole thing was well set up, and I think Jonathan, you contributed to some of the premise for that. So, well done, and thank you. But obviously it is to raise money for the festival for next year. So hopefully it'll do some of that.
And that book, of course, is The Kraken Rises, available from Amazon and various other ebook stores where Angry Robot books can be found. And our thanks to our friends at Angry Robot. Pete, did that actually set a world record for the fastest produced anthology?
It has been put to the world record people, and we're waiting to hear back from them.
Alrighty, so Guinness Book of Records, let's hope you get your act together fairly quickly. The final thing I want to ask you, Ian, is I noticed from your anthology that you also write about comics. I guess you're a comic reviewer, so could you tell people where to find your writing?
I write occasional articles for Back Issue Magazine, which is a magazine that really focuses on comics from the sort of 70s through to the 90s, which is probably when I did most of my comic reading, although I do still read comics. I have one example down there which people are willing to happy to have a look at. They do, it's Tomorrow's Publishing, who keep everything in print but also do quite reasonably priced digital editions, so feel free to investigate that and explore. So the last one I did was an issue themed on the British invasion of American comics in the 1980s, so I did a article on that on Warrior magazine and the creators who went from that into American comics. Have a look for that. It's a good magazine anyway.
Oh, dear old Warrior. Quick shout out for Des Skin, although I don't suppose he's going to be listening. Now, on to Jonathan. I probably asked you this when I had you on the Ujima radio show, but why comedy stories about necromancers?
Nobody else was doing that. The character came to me by a process of evolution, and it was simply a case of these. I think the best reason for any author to write is nobody else has written this and I would like to read it. That's pretty much the direction that Johannes Cabal came from.
The one thing that you didn't read from today was the other life that you have. I mean, we have Ian Banks and we have Ian M. Banks, but you've got this cunning pseudonym that you have Jonathan L. Howard, who does the Johannes Cabal books, and Jonathan L. Howard, who does YA rip-roaring science fiction adventure stories for Strange Chemistry, which I thought was very, very cunning of you. So how is the career as a YA author going?
Quite nicely, actually. I've had some very, very nice reviews for the first YA novel I wrote, which was Catcher's World, first of the Rusalka Chronicles, and the first sequel, Catcher's War, came out about a fortnight or so ago. That's getting good reviews as well. So, yes, again, it's from the point of view of, I used to love reading that kind of stuff when I was a young adult myself. So it's the kind of thing I enjoyed then and the kind of thing that I enjoy writing now.
The thing I remember from the radio show is you said that you actually didn't have a contract when you started off, that you wanted to write some stories for your daughter that inspired you the way that Heinlein and Co. had inspired you when you were a kid.
Yes, that's true. I wrote the original version of Catcher's World, but it was called Deep Black. It must have been 3 or 4, maybe even 5 years before it was actually sold. And it was with no intention of selling it in the first instance. And I ran it past my agent, and my agent's opinion was, but it's not fantasy. It doesn't have romantic triangles and stuff in it. And it's got some quite hard science fiction in it. I'll try and see what I can do. And when he got back from his down round of the publishers, that was pretty much the experience he had first time round. So bless Strange Chemistry for actually taking a punt on something a bit different.
Thank you very much, people. And before I switch all the electronics off, the fabulous Claire is going to tell us all about next month.
Yes, on the Monday the 16th of December, we're going to have our very own Joanne Hall and Kevin Henning. It's going to be fun.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.